So this Advent and Christmas season, we are continuing a practice we began last year of reading old books together in Sunday school, adult Sunday school. Last year we looked at the Incarnation by Athanasius, On the Incarnation. And this year we're looking at a book that's more modern, but still, I think, old, certainly from a different era, and that is Life Together by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And I think all of you at this point probably have a copy of it, or at least have had a chance to get a copy of it. There are several more, I think, on the bookcase in the foyer if you need them. So last week we began just by sort of giving a little introduction to the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And I think it's important when you come to a book like this to realize the context in which it was written, the audience for which it was written, what was going on in the writer's life. We talked about that last year, right, with Athanasius and the fact that On the Incarnation was written in a polemic context, one in which the Council of Nicaea was happening and there were debates about the divinity of Christ, of Jesus, and so Athanasius was dealing with those things when he wrote that work. In a similar way, Bonhoeffer is dealing with historical situations, of course, in his own life when he writes this work as well. It doesn't come to us just decontextualized out of the heavens, but from a particular time and place. So let's just do a little bit of overview before we jump into some of the details. Who was Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Where is he from? What's his nationality? He's a German man. And when did he live approximately? Yeah, 1920s, 30s, 40s. He was born, I think, 1906. Yeah, born to a wealthy German family in 06. What else did we talk about last week with him? What about his education did we discuss? Yeah, well-educated, right? He does his degree, I think, at the age of 21. He has his dissertation written. And remember that there was a... who's the theologian that read... Bonhoeffer's dissertation and remarked on it as a marvel? Yeah, Karl Barth. So Karl Barth, really the preeminent theologian of the day, is reading this 21-year-old's dissertation and not just reading it, but publicly praising it. That's a big deal. That wasn't happening to me when I was 21. I don't know about you. I was much more anonymous than that. What do we learn from that about Bonhoeffer in terms of his personality and gifts and all that? He's a bright young man, right? He's even more than bright. He's kind of a prodigy. He comes from a well-educated family. His father is a neurobiologist in Berlin. He comes from the upper crust, so to speak. We talked about last time about how he was someone who was trained as a musician, right? A classical pianist. These are the realms in which he operated very smoothly and fluidly. We also talked last week about how what happened to Bonhoeffer's older brother, Walter. Anybody remember that? Yeah, he was killed in World War I. And why is that significant? Not so much necessarily for Bonhoeffer's life in particular, but for the German culture at the time. How does World War I fit into the picture of Bonhoeffer's life if he was born in 1908 or so, or 1906? It didn't end well. Yeah, it was a defeat for Germany. So World War I, right, we have the sort of the Allied forces, France and Britain and Canada and America kind of came together and fought on one side with some other nations, and Germany was fighting against them, and of course they lost, and that meant that the side that won, the American, British, French side, was able to impose terms, right? There was an important treaty. Remember the name of that treaty? Treaty of Versailles. The Treaty of Versailles was, at least by the Germans, was that perceived to be a positive thing or something that was a negative? No, it was a great sort of stripe on their national identity, right? It was perceived to be a great humiliation. They had to give up some territory. They were not allowed to militarize. They gave up things in trade, benefits. There's financial costs, there were military costs, there were just national pride costs that came as a result of losing that war, and maybe that was justified, I don't know. But In any case, what was the result of that for the German people in the next 15, 20 years? So it was a time of suffering for the German people, a time of humiliation, a time of even just economic loss. And so what that kind of created, I think we can say, a vacuum, right? That created a vacuum for someone that would come along and begin to talk about the good old days or talk about the glory days ahead, what could be. And, of course, that person is Adolf Hitler, right? One of the most famous people of the 20th century, comes along in the late 20s, early 30s, and begins to amass political power. And so that's sort of the context in which Bonhoeffer lives. And then as Hitler takes power around 1933 or so, what is happening in the German church at the time? Around 1933. How are they responding to the rise of Nazism? Are they a voice crying in the wilderness, or are they pretty, you know, interested to see where this goes? What's that? Right. Yeah. Yeah, so the German church at this time is not really a critic of Hitler. You know, it's easy for us to sort of right now say, oh, if I'd been there, obviously we would have been, you know, writing articles and protesting Hitler and all this kind of stuff. But at the time, that wasn't the case in the German church, largely. There was a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of hope that maybe this would be a sort of messianic person who would lead them forward. And so the church gets on board. They pass this Arian clause that basically says that if you're, well, the church becomes nationalized, really unified for the first time and connected to the state in 33. And then they add this Arian clause that says if you're Jewish or you're not Arian, if you're not pure blood, quote unquote, then you're not allowed to be in the ministry, or if you're married to someone who's not Arian. And so there was a segment of the church that disagreed with this, right? What was that, the name of that group that kind of pulled out, so to speak? Yeah, the Confessing Church. And so Karl Barth was a part of that group. Bonhoeffer was a part of that group, a much more junior member of that group. And they wrote what was called the Barmen Declaration, right? This statement about we refuse any political power that tries to take ultimate authority. Our allegiance is to Christ. These kinds of things are said. So Bonhoeffer is a part of all those things. That's about where we got last time. We got up to about 1935, and so things right now, the Confessing Church is sort of a voice in the wilderness at this point. They're beginning to be excluded from any positions of authority or power or institutional kind of weight. And so what they're doing in 1935 is beginning to set up sort of an alternate system, an alternate church within Germany. They're still loyal Germans, more or less. They're just disagreeing with what's happened politically and beginning to set up alternate structures within their society. And so Bonhoeffer has been called by this Confessing Church, the leadership within it, to start a new underground illegal seminary. This wasn't the only one. There were seven or eight at this time that were being started around Germany. And the idea was that they would train pastors outside of the normal system, because the normal systems were all controlled by the state church. You had to be basically at this point loyal to the Nazi government in order to participate in those structures. So Bonhoeffer does that. So he goes for 2 years and leads this underground seminary, and that really is the place where this book comes from. This book is, just kind of comes out of that time period, that experience of them living together. We'll talk more in detail about what that was like. Before we get there, I think really to understand Life Together, you have to understand the book that was written previously to Life Together, which is Cost of Discipleship. Cost of Discipleship is really written during that time in Finkenwald, the underground seminary from 1935 to 37. And Cost of Discipleship is the name of this work. It's really one of the more famous evangelical kind of works in the 20th century. What's the basic message of Cost of Discipleship? Anybody read that book? Anyone? A couple parts of it at least. What's the basic argument of Bonhoeffer in that book? Grace is cheap, right? There is a cost. There is a cost to grace. There is a cost of discipleship that the church has has really, really was in many ways, it was impossible to read that book at the time without seeing it as what it was, which was a critique of the German church, the nationalistic German church that had gone along with the Nazi government. So this is some of the just excerpts from the book. He says things like, cheap grace is the preaching of forgiveness without requiring repentance, baptism without church discipline, communion without confession, absolution without personal confession. Cheap grace is grace without discipleship, grace without the cross, grace without Jesus Christ, living and incarnate. And I think that even that phrase, grace without Jesus Christ is cheap grace, is really a good way to think about this book. Really, cost of discipleship is an exposition of the Sermon on the Mount. And basically what he's doing is he's critiquing what he perceives to be a system within the German church that has disconnected grace from the person of Christ. So grace becomes this substance that the church can give freely without any consequences or requirements or reciprocal kind of actions, because it's disconnected from the person of Christ. It's disassociated from him. And so his basic argument was that grace is free. Grace is, God's gift to the human race, but it comes through the person of Jesus, through union with him, and you have to follow him. You have to be a part of his people if you're going to be a part of the grace that you receive. Costly grace is the treasure hidden in the field. For the sake of it, a man will go and sell all he has. Of course, it's the parable Jesus told. It is the pearl of great price to buy, which the merchant will sell all his goods. It is the kingly rule of Christ. For those whose sake a man will pluck out the eye which causes him to stumble. Of course, that comes out of the Sermon on the Mount. It is the call of Jesus Christ at which the disciple leaves his net and follows him. Costly grace is the gospel which must be sought again and again, the gift which must be asked for, the door at which a man must knock. You see, again, just the way he's weaving through even the language that Jesus used to describe his kingdom. Such grace is costly because it calls us to follow, and it is grace because it calls us to follow Jesus Christ. So it's connected to the person of Jesus. It is costly because it costs a man his life, and it is grace because it gives a man the only true life. It is costly because it condemns sin, and grace because it justifies the sinner. Above all, it is costly because it cost God the life of his Son. You were bought at a price. And what has cost God much cannot be cheap for us. Above all, it is grace because God did not reckon his Son too dear a price to pay for our life, but delivered him up for us. Costly grace is the incarnation of God. Any thoughts about that or questions about that basic argument that he makes? Essentially, what he's critiquing is a kind of nominalism, right? That's come into the German church. This idea that, okay, if you're German, you're baptized, you're Christian, full stop. Like, you live basically how you want at that point. You're in the church. Of course you're a Christian. You're a Lutheran, right? You come out of the tradition of Martin Luther. How could it be otherwise? And so really, like many throughout the centuries, in some ways this is what the Reformation, Protestant Reformation was about, was critiquing that kind of idea of Christianity, that Christianity is just something that is connected with national identity or ethnic identity. He's saying, no, it's something else. It's something more than that. It is grace, but it is grace that is not cheap. Make sense? Okay. So very much a political work as well as a theological one at the time. 1937, he publishes Cost of Discipleship. Finkenwald is closed by the Gestapo at that point. Now, it's not like it's not like they all kicked down the doors and everybody was taken in chains and thrown off from the concentration camps. That kind of thing was not happening yet, at least to people like Bonhoeffer, people who were upper crust and those that were part of his school. No one was imprisoned, but they broke it up. They said, you can't do here, you can't do this, you have to go somewhere else, you have to be scattered. And Bonhoeffer at this time was beginning to be increasingly pushed out. I think in 39 he was not allowed to go to Berlin anymore, sort of pushed out of into the periphery of society at this point. 1939, this is a really crucial moment in Bonhoeffer's life. He goes to America, does a tour, academic tour, speaks at different universities, and has opportunities to talk about his theological perspective, his experience, certainly, in Finkenwald, what's going on in Nazi Germany. He's offered positions at this point. I mean, you can imagine, right? He has the opportunity to stay, to be a tenured professor, to be, you know, maybe in a different world, a different life, Bonhoeffer chooses to stay in America. And he's there for the next, you know, maybe he dies in 1987, you know, and he lives a full life. I mean, that's basically what happened with Karl Barth. Karl Barth leaves Germany, goes to Switzerland, isn't really affected by the war, and continues on and writes a great number of works. And that could easily have been the case for Bonhoeffer. But he decides, because of his convictions about what grace is, about who Jesus is, about his own personal calling vocationally, he decides to go back. He decides to leave America in 1939. He knows that the doors are closing. It's likely he's not going to be able to travel like this again. But he goes back. He says, I must live through this difficult period of our national history with the Christian people of Germany. And so not just the Germans, but in particular the Christian people in Germany. I have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share the trials of this time with my people. So he goes and identifies himself in that place. In 1939, he returns to Germany to avoid the draft, which is beginning to happen as Germany militarizes and builds an army. He joins the, I don't know how to pronounce that, how do you say it? Abwehr? That sounds great. We'll go with that. So Abwehr is the German intelligence, like the CIA of the German nation at this time. So he is able to become a German spy, basically, essentially. He avoids the draft. He avoids sort of the close watch of the Gestapo. He outwardly is acting like a loyal German citizen. During this time, he works with his brother, his brother-in-law, Donnany? I don't know how to say that either. So he begins to work with his brother-in-law. It's very clear from the documents that his brother-in-law was involved in various plots against Hitler. He begins to store documents he's part of this Abwehr. He's part of this German intelligence. But within that German intelligence, this was one of the pockets of German society that was becoming increasingly disloyal to Hitler. So it's not clear exactly how involved Bonhoeffer is in those things. It's clear that his brother-in-law is. At 1943, he's arrested. He's arrested at that point for subversion of the armed forces. He's been traveling for some of his church work and appears to have been involved in protecting Jews and getting Jews out of the country at different times. So it's not clear certainly at that point, they don't realize the extent of the plot. He's not necessarily being arrested and charged with conspiring to kill Hitler at that point. 1943, he's put in prison. He's in prison for 2 years. Then in 1944, about a year later, evidence of this plot, the Abwehr plot, which was not successful, was one of several plots against Hitler, was discovered. These papers were discovered. Bonhoeffer's brother-in-law is directly connected to this assassination attempt or plot against Hitler. And Bonhoeffer gets caught up in that. And again, it's never clear exactly how much he precisely had to do with what was going on, especially, in his correspondence and his interactions with the Germans. He says exactly what you would expect him to say, regardless of whether he was innocent or guilty, right? He says, I didn't do it, basically. He says, I'm loyal, all these kinds of things. But of course, he knows at that point that his correspondence is being monitored. He knows that everything is being closely read. Finally, in 1945, as it becomes more clear that the war is going to end with Germany losing, Hitler at the very end of his life becomes he was a paranoid guy all of his life, but especially the last year or two, begins to try to wipe out as many people that he didn't perceive to be loyal to himself. And so Bonhoeffer is convicted of treason in a really sham trial that happens, early one morning in a space of an hour or two. Military trial, and the next day he's executed, along with his brother-in-law. Two of his brother-in-laws, actually, and I think two of his brothers are actually killed, too. So within that family, imagine his parents, they'd already lost their their oldest son, Walter, in World War I, and then two of their daughters lose their husbands, and two of their sons were also killed by the German government. So it was very clear that there was something going on that Bonhoeffer was a part of. It's never, we're probably not going to know exactly, you know, how deeply was he involved in particular in trying to kill Hitler in particular, or was he just merely participating in a broader sort of resistance against the German government? And then, of course, about a month later, Germany surrenders, and VE Day happens. And so really, a week or two later, and the German or American troops would have been there and would have stopped his execution. Any questions about that? Okay, good. All right, so let's talk a little bit about Finkenwald. So before, this is 1935, Bonhoeffer writes a letter to his brother explaining his decision to accept this call to go and to be part of this seminary, to start this seminary. And he describes it this way. He says, "The restoration of the church must surely depend on a new kind of monasticism, which has nothing in common with the old, but a life of uncompromising discipleship, following Christ according to the Sermon on the Mount. I believe the time has come to gather the people together and to do this." I think that phrase that he uses there, a new kind of monasticism, is really interesting. That's how he's describing what he understands himself to be doing as he gathers these seminarians and they go and live together and do this life together, a new kind of monasticism. Now, I want to connect that for you. I don't know if y'all, is that large enough to read? This is a book named, I don't know if Alistair McIntyre read Bonhoeffer. He uses language that's similar enough. Alistair McIntyre is a British or Scottish writer, theologian, who writes this book, After Virtue, in 1981. Basically, the argument of that book is that in earlier days, there were patterns of virtue that were commonly agreed upon that sustained community life. And people sort of knew together, agreed upon what was good and what was bad. There were systems of virtue that sustain common life within Western society. But his argument basically is that in the late modernity, the late last part of the 20th century, those patterns are going away. And so now we're entering a period that is after virtue. So what does that mean? So his whole book is sort of a defense of that thesis for it. And then he has the very last page of that work, he says this. He says, "It is always dangerous to draw too precise parallels between one historical period and another. And among the most misleading of such parallels are those which have been drawn between our own age in Europe and North America and the epoch in which the Roman Empire declined into the Dark Ages. Nonetheless, certain parallels there are. A crucial turning point in that earlier history occurred when men and women of goodwill turned aside from the task of shoring up the Roman Imperium and cease to identify the continuation of civility and moral community with the maintenance of that Imperium. What they set themselves to achieve instead, often not recognizing fully what they were doing, was the construction of new forms of community within which the moral life could be sustained so that both morality and civility might survive the coming ages of barbarism and darkness. If my account of our moral condition is correct, we also ought to conclude that for some time now we too have reached that turning point. What matters at this stage is the construction of local forms of community within which civility and the intellectual and moral life can be sustained through the new dark ages which are already upon us. And if the tradition of virtues was able to survive the horrors of the last dark ages, we are not entirely without grounds for hope. This time, however, the barbarians are not waiting beyond the frontiers. They have already been governing us for quite some time. And it is our lack of consciousness of this that constitutes part of our predicament. We are waiting not for a Godot, but for another, doubtless very different, Saint Benedict." Who is Saint Benedict? Yeah, Benedict was someone who lived in the 6th century. who saw the dissolution of the Roman Empire and the fragmented nature of society in which he was living, was concerned about that in terms of especially the way in which the church was becoming fragmented, and those patterns of morality and of common life were passing away. And he decided, as Eric just said, it's time for a new monastic movement that is not, up to then, the monastic movement had largely been about one guy or one or two guys going out and living in the wilderness so they could commune with God on their own. Benedict said, no, what we need are communities of men and communities of women that are going to live a common life together, that are going to be a place of hospitality, a place of welcome, but a place that is distinct from the world around it, so that we can preserve the Christian faith, basically, within this context. Now, of course, he wasn't thinking, okay, this is going to influence the church for the next 500 years. He was just thinking, I'm just a guy. You know, this is what I think I should do. But it had the effect of that. The Benedictine movement was really, you know, if you've read some of the histories of that age, the monastic movement was really important in terms of sustaining the Christian life through that period. Now, of course, there abuses came into those systems that happened later. I mean, part of the Reformation was a protest against some of those abuses within the monastic tradition. But early on, those abuses weren't necessarily present in the same way. So MacIntyre is pointing to Benedict, and it seems also that I just bring this up because I think it's interesting that Bonhoeffer talks about this new kind of monasticism, this new kind of separate common life to sustain the church through this age and build towards something new. That's the reason I bring up this is that's what the context of this book is. It's important to say this book is not. This book is very idealized in some ways. It's important to know that. Bonhoeffer's writing to a community of men who are unmarried. It's all men. It's about 15 or 20 guys. There's no women or children, right? Which means they're largely free from the responsibilities that come with those things. They're living together intentionally in community. They're doing so for a time, not indefinitely, but for a specific time period. And this isn't monastic in the sense that these men have all taken vows of chastity and obedience and poverty or anything. It's just a temporary period in which they're living together. But it's important to see that Bonhoeffer felt like in order to sustain the church through this time, this is the kind of way that we need to begin to think about living together. We're going to do it in a really intense way during this time. But what does that mean for everyone else, I think, is the question. Does that make sense? Okay, that's a lot of information. Now, part of the reason I'm bringing this up is I've used that quote before, the MacIntyre quote. I think increasingly this is how we need to think about church life. Not that we're all going to be monks together or something, but we do need to think about what does it mean for us to be an intentional community that's sustaining the common life together through a culture that is increasingly either outward or, you know, explicitly hostile or at least indifferent to the goals and aims of the Christian life. The only way that we survive that is through common life together, through a kind of new monasticism in a sense, certainly not in the extreme sense that Benedict had or even that Bonhoeffer is talking about here, but intentional forms of community life. We're not going to be sustained just by intellectually thinking correct thoughts. We're going to be sustained by patterns of life together. Prayer, sacrament, word, you know, these kinds of things being at the center of who we are. That's what's going to sustain us through this age, I think. So that's part of the reason why I want to do this book. All right, I'm going to pass out this handout. Can I get some help, Todd, or somebody? Thanks. Okay, this handout is, it's titled Reminiscences of Finkenwald. And it's by a man named Paul Bussing. Now, Paul Bussing is writing this because he was one of the students who lived through this period, these 2 years, with Bonhoeffer at this underground seminary, this kind of new monastic thing that they were doing together, this experiment, really an experiment together in a common life. So I think it's really interesting to see how he reflects on that experience and the way that he describes what their life together was like. If you look in the first section, he says, "In my days at a German university, no one took any responsibility for nurturing the spiritual life of a candidate for ministry. Unless we theology students went on our own initiative to a student pastor or professor for help, we were dependent entirely on our own resources." So preparation for the ministry was about academic work, basically. And then if you look in the next next paragraph on the opposite side of the page, he says, "Had it been otherwise, the situation of the church and her ministers might have been very different when in 1933 the days of trial and persecution began." So basically the argument that he's making here is, maybe if our common life had been different, if it hadn't just been academic, we would have been better situated to resist what happened in 1933. Then came Finkenwald, he says. He talks about how most of the seminaries at this time had been, or all the seminaries really, had been taken over by the German National Church, and so they drew away together near the Baltic Sea in northeastern Germany. It was basically a very, you know, one large house that they lived in, a kind of rambling manor that needed a lot of work. And so part of their life together was working on the house. He describes this experience that they had together. If you turn the page, at the very top of the second page, he says, "We came from every part of the Reich. All of us had some experience in the ministry of the Word of God and knew something of what was involved in that ministry in the Third Reich. None of us had any illusions about the future. Most of us had passed a first exam, given under the auspices of the confessional church, which we knew would not be recognized as legal by the Nazi state or by the authorities of the state church." The next paragraph he says, "But nothing could alter our course or change our attitude. Not even an evening paper that excited brother brought from Stettin on December 1st, 1935, so the very beginning of this seminary's life together. That paper reported a decree signed by Himmler that the Nazi minister and the Nazi minister of the interior, declaring that all exams held before courts of the confessional church were invalid, all training centers set up by the church subject to closure, and all participants in them liable to punishment. We assembled that evening in Bonhoeffer's room. All of us felt that we should go on as usual, unless and until prevented by force from doing so." And then if you look on section 3, he begins to describe what their life together was like. "We members of the community..." So give, I think it's just interesting, given this context, this really stark, significant, hard context that they're in, what are the things that Bonhoeffer decides to emphasize? How should these men spend their life together? If they're going to have a year or two, maybe. And then who knows what's going to happen, right? What do you emphasize? Do you read a bunch of Karl Barth? Do you, you know, what do you do? "We members of the community rose in silence each morning, then assembled in silence in the dining room for prayers. None of us was allowed to speak before God himself had spoken to us, and we had sung our morning praise to him. There was a fixed form for these prayers, which was also used each evening. After a hymn, one or more of the psalms were read antiphonally. The Old Testament lesson was followed by a verse or two of a hymn that was used for a week or more. After the reading from the New Testament, one of us offered prayers. Morning worship closed with the singing of another hymn. Then again in silence, we went to our dormitories to make our beds and put things in order. Next came breakfast, during which we continued to practice silence. After breakfast, we returned to our studies, which each of us shared with one or two of his fellows. For half an hour, our task was one of meditation on a short passage from the German Bible, a passage about which we were asked to center our thoughts for a week, not to gather ideas for our next sermon or to examine it exegetically, but to discover what it had to say to us. We were to pray over it, to think of our life in its light, and to use it as a basis for intercession on behalf of our brethren, our families, and all who we knew to be in special need or difficulty. Such meditation did not come easily to us, for few of us had learned to read the Bible devotionally. Then, only then, do we undertake the strictly academic activities of the day." And he describes those. For a few hours, they'd have lectures and work on papers and those kinds of things. Then the next paragraph down, he says, "The lessons over, we had half an hour to ourselves before assembling in the chapel for community hymn singing. Even though most of us had hitherto regarded ourselves as musically illiterate, we all took part in the singing, for we felt the need and the inner compulsion to do so. Under the vigorous and masterly direction of our choir master, we both profited from and contributed to the experience. The hymns of the ancient church, of the reformers, of the Bohemian brethren, of those..." And that doesn't mean the Greenwich Village in the 1970s. "Of those who had lived and suffered through the 30 Years' War, all came alive for us, and we felt them to be our own. They mirrored our situation. They echoed our praise. They voiced our petitions. They articulated our repentance. In this group experience, the church became again a living reality for us, a church without boundaries or time or place. And we became increasingly conscious of ourselves as her members, and as men committed to her service, come what may. The interlude between lunch and tea was unscheduled, but homework was the order of the day after tea. In the evening, we had further lectures or discussion. Evening prayers were at 9:30, taking much the same form as those of the morning. Thereafter, we were expected to maintain silence until bedtime, for God's word was to be the last word of the day, just as had been the first." We all think about that. That was not my seminary experience, let me tell you. And I know that the Venzels and Eric and others that have, Aaron that have been to seminary. I don't know if y'all resonate with this at all. This is very different. Yeah, it does sound awesome. I agree. That's right. This is the part I'd see. Yes, ma'am. Yes, KB. I don't believe so. I think they were all unmarried. I think probably they mean their immediate families, parents and siblings and that kind of thing. I believe that's the case. Yeah, I think these are all unmarried men. Yes, ma'am.
It sounds like the monastery.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think it was, parts of it at least, were very intentionally modeled on the monastic life, the Benedictine rule, those kinds of things. Yeah, Mike. Yeah, I don't know if there was a particular one. I'm sure that the Benedictine rule was a, and that was really the reason why, we talked about Benedict earlier, why he became, had the most influence as he did, was because he wrote this document called the Benedictine Rule, which became sort of the document that shaped monastic life in the West for the next 1,000 years. Yeah, Eric. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, Bonhoeffer was very much that way. He was very much he had allegiances in both directions. A kind of a German pietist sort of, you need to meditate on just one or two verses and think about what they mean for you personally, and but also had these, we should have formal readings and formal prayers and hymns, and so yeah, he definitely had sympathies in both those directions. Yeah, John.
I don't see that anybody
loses
around gathering
crops. Yeah. Good point. Yeah, that's a little unrealistic as well, right? Somebody's got to do all the work. I do know there was some work that was involved. Certainly they had common life together. He doesn't talk about it as much here, but if you read other documents, biography and those kinds of things, they were doing chores together and those kinds of things. There were servants, so there were people that were helping with those tasks as well. They weren't just on their own. They were, so that's obviously a little different. Yeah, KB. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right. No, no Facebook. Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. If I can just get away, then. Right. Absolutely. Yeah, Casey. How old? Bonhoeffer was not old at all. He was about 29, and he was one of the eldest. So a lot of young men, yeah, in their 20s, basically. Yeah. Yes, yes. That's right, that's right. Yeah, it's not necessarily an easy thing to sit in silence for an hour, half an hour every day and just look at it. And if you read, you know, writings by monks during throughout the ages, you see the same kind of thing, that like, we think this is really good what we're doing, this pattern of life, but it's really hard, and we get really bored and depressed, and we have thoughts we wish we didn't have, and, you know, like, it's not like this is some sort of community that, you know, is just... There was no sin. There was no, you know, problems. It was a hard thing. The last thing I want to leave you with before we wrap up today is to see that this, for Bonhoeffer, this wasn't just to be a place to isolate and sort of survive the next, you know, decade or something. If you read the next several paragraphs down on that same column that we were looking at a minute ago, he says, "During my stay at Finkenwald, many of us had preaching engagements on Sundays. Others worked in Sunday schools. Still others served as assistant ministers in nearby confessional churches. Shortly after I left in April of 36, a practice was introduced that soon became a major activity. We began to spend long weekends or even longer periods as in a village. We'd go out in apostolic companies, two by two, staying with folk who are willing to act as hosts. During the morning, we'd go from house to house, visiting people, talking to them, inviting them to a meeting in the church or hall. Sometimes afternoon meetings were arranged for women or for children, but the evening gatherings for everyone. At these meetings, we spoke of what was involved in leading a Christian life as a farmer or a teacher, as a merchant or a laborer, as a parent or a child in Nazi Germany. We tried to help the people see that the Christian life means carrying Christ's cross with him and his discipleship, and that only by following him can we be of his flock. The brethren who remained at Finkenwald undergirded us as evangelists with their prayers and supplications. When people became aware of this, they caught a glimpse of the common life of Christians, manifest in a preaching, teaching, and praying church. Nor did we evangelists underrate the importance of a spiritual home to which we could return for new strength and inspiration, for a deeper understanding of God's word and the obligations it laid upon us." I think it's really important to see that for Bonhoeffer, this wasn't just, we're just going to get away and batten the hatches and, you know, hide. It was, we need a place, a center, to be formed, and from that center, we can then go out and minister to the German people from that position of strength rather than one of just sort of being blown around by the cultural winds. We have a rooted place. And I think that really is, that's basically my hope for our church, you know, is that we will be, we're not going to all live together and do all these things, but hopefully we can be a central place that is a place of spiritual strength and fortitude and calm and peace that can then encourage us and strengthen us to go and to serve our neighbors and to live our lives and to work and to raise our children, you know, all these different vocations that we have. I think this is a picture of what I hope, I think the church should be, what I hope our church in particular will be. Make sense? Sorry, I know that again, that's a lot of stuff. I'm just throwing it at you.